Hello and welcome to Growing Up B2B. I'm Ed D'Elia, president of D'Elia Associates, the place where B2B brands go to grow. For over 60 years, and now across two generations, we've been helping B2B companies achieve next-level growth through brand distinction, quality lead generation, and sales enablement. Growing Up B2B was created for family business leaders who are passionate about growth, legacy, and making a lasting impact. Whether it's a multi-generational legacy or multiple family members working together, there's something truly magical about blending business with family. And we want to celebrate that right here on Growing Up B2B. So be sure to stick around to the end of the show and find out how you can be our next guest. Okay, let's get into it. Hello and welcome to another episode of Growing Up B2B. I'm your host, Ed D'Elia, second generation president of D'Elia Associates, the place where B2B brands go to grow. Today, I'm joined by Scott Weintraub, a coach with Scaling Up Coaches and someone who has lived the family business journey from multiple angles. Scott built and sold his own company after more than a decade of growth, co-owned and operated a fantastic Sam's franchise with his wife and children, and now coaches founders, leadership teams, and family-run companies across the country. With a career that began at Procter & Gamble and then Pfizer, and later shifted into entrepreneurship and coaching, Scott has seen what works and what breaks inside family businesses of every size and model. He brings an unusually candid and practical lens to the realities of working with spouses, raising the next generation inside the company, navigating succession, and applying the Scaling Up framework in environments where emotions, legacy, and shared history run deep. Scott, welcome to Growing Up B2B.
Thanks, Dan. So excited to be here.
Same here. So let's start with your own story, if you would. You've owned companies, run a franchise with your wife, built a firm you later sold. Now you're coaching dozens of founders. What do you, when you look back, like what do you consider kind of the first true chapter of your entrepreneurial journey?
Yes. So you might not have even been born, but in 1973.
I was.
Okay. In 1973, when you were 1 year old or whatever, there were these huge gas lines because you could only buy gas every other day. There was an energy crisis. Nixon was president. And I saw these huge lines at the gas station. I was 10 years old at the time. And I figured, hey, I could probably make money selling orange juice, coffee, and bagels to these people. So I got a red wagon I had. My mom would make the coffee and bagels, and I would walk up and down the line. It was four blocks from my house selling bagels. And as a third grader, I made a fortune. I mean, it was so much money. And then after a couple of days, my mom started charging me for the raw materials. And I still made a lot of money, but I learned a lot of lessons there. And it was great. And then in actually high school, I went over to my buddy's house, and they used to have punch cards for computers. So they had these cards and it punched. Yeah. His dad worked at IBM. So he gets home from work and he like brushes his shirt and off come the little Chads. And I say, hey, what are those things? And he explains it to me. I said, hey, what do they do with those? He goes, it's garbage. We just throw them out. So I said, hey, can I get a couple garbage bags full of those? He's like, sure. What are you going to do with it? I said, don't worry. So I put them into little baggies and I sold them as confetti at the high school football games. I walked around 50 cents a bag, three for a buck. And every time our team scored, people threw them up in the air. So those were the, you know, two things that I'd say really started. And then in college, I actually one more thing about the high school. So I get called down to the principal's office one day, and he's like, hey, I heard you're selling confetti at the games. Everybody loves it. This is a great idea. Is that you, Scott? I said, yeah. And I was really proud. He goes, hey, who's going to clean up all that confetti in the stands? And I'm like, I don't know. And he's like, hey, I got good news. And he calls in the janitor. He goes, look, he has two brooms. I already talked to, you know, your math teacher. You're going to miss math today. And you're going to go out there and sweep that up. So it lasted about five or six games, almost a full season, until I got that shut down. But then in college, during the summer, I worked at a swimming pool company, opening swimming pools, fixing swimming pools. And then the last year, me and my buddy who worked there said, hey, we should probably open our own swimming pool store. So instead of working for someone, we just opened our own. We opened pools. The biggest swimming pool store near us was called Central Jersey Pool and Supply. So we decided to call our company Jersey Central Pool and Supply. At the time, I didn't realize that was illegal, but we did it. We made flyers. You know, he went into his dad's office because photocopies back then were 10 cents each. That's a lot of money. Sure. Went to his father's office, made them. We passed it out to anyone in the neighborhood who had a fence. We figured they might have a pool. And again, made a lot of money. But probably the Fantastic Sam's that you mentioned was the first one that it was a big enough franchise that, you know, it was enough money to support a household as opposed to, even though I made a lot of money in third grade selling bagels, probably couldn't have paid all my bills with that.
So let's go back to that for a minute. Those are three really interesting scenarios, all pretty much, I guess, before you even got to college, right? Those were
yes.
All high school and grade school. Where did that come from? Like, was that something that you got from your folks, from another relative? Was that just your own intuitions that said, hey, this looks like a good idea?
You know, the bagel one, which was, you know, the first one, I just saw these lines and I saw people standing outside and we were in a car waiting online to buy gas and these people. And I'm like, oh, they're like bored out of their skull. They're reading the newspaper back then. And I'm like, oh, you know, I don't know if my brother or somebody said, hey, dad, I'm hungry. I need something. And that was kind of the light bulb. Mm-hmm. It was either my brother or my mother or my father. Someone was complaining about being hungry or thirsty. I'm like, hey, I could sell stuff here. So that's what I did. I was in school, so I couldn't really sell during the week. But on Saturday and Sunday, it was coffees, orange juice, bagels, and clean up. So I guess it was, you know, someone in the car said, hey, there's a need. They didn't use these terms. Hey, there's a need for people waiting an hour and a half in line for food. Someone should sell food. And I was that someone.
That's interesting. I mean, if I were to look at all of the, all three scenarios, I mean, I would say they all looked like somehow you had in you to see there's an opportunity where one didn't exist before. There's an opportunity to sell something more to these people in line. There's an opportunity to turn waste into profit. You know, with the
right
guards, there's an opportunity to take home more than we are by working for someone. We'll work for ourselves, you know, so basically looking, seeing an opportunity where one didn't exist and then going and creating it. I mean, I think that's a rather unique capability to have. And you just demonstrated it three times before you even set foot in college. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, when my mom started charging for the bagels, you know, my profit got cut by, you know, 50%, right? Because cost mm-hmm. of goods, I didn't know the term cost of goods, but cost of goods became 50%. So then when I saw the Chads, the computer Chads, it was like, oh, free cost of goods. This can be massive profit again. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, until I had to sweep up and the principal put an end to it, it was a good deal for a short while. Yeah.
So let's fast forward to Fantastic Sam's for a moment. So you and your wife co-owned it.
Yeah.
Kids worked there too. So if you look back, you know, and say, you know, as I assess that chapter, what surprised you most about running a true family business from the inside?
Yes. Yeah, so the biggest surprise was my title was president. I came up with the vision. I did the hiring and firing, but I also mopped the floor, cleaned the toilets and everything in between. And I guess for me, I really thought if you were president, you didn't do all that stuff. It had to get done and I cared the most. So I did stuff like that. So many nights we were open until 7 at night. After dinner, me and my wife would get in our car, drive over. It was 3 miles from our house. And even though they were supposed to clean up every day, we cleaned again. You know, we wanted it to be spotless at 9 o'clock the next morning. So that was most surprising is I really did everything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. So when we were talking once before, you joked, you said, hey, you know, being on your show, listen, I've made every family business mistake possible. So if you were to look back, what was maybe one or two that were, hey, this was a big one. And you wish maybe someone had kind of been there to say, hey, watch out. You're about to step into a trap or about to fall into the pit.
So like me and my wife, we didn't have clear roles. Therefore, we didn't stay in our lanes because we didn't have really clear roles. And I remember vividly, she gets home one day and she's like, oh, I just want to let you know I fired Denise. I'm like, you fired Denise? Why'd you fire Denise? Ah, she's a pain in the neck, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I said, you know, Denise is our number one producer. Because she said to me, actually, she goes, do you like Denise? And I said, I love Denise. She's like, what do you mean you love Denise? I said, she's our number one producer. Like, of course I like Denise. And that was the big thing is, you know, I thought I had hiring and firing, but we didn't ever sit down and say, this is your role, this is mine. We just kind of evolved into it. And I did plenty of stepping on her, et cetera, et cetera. So we never really sat down like you would, you know, at Procter & Gamble. You show up and people are super clear. This is your job. And, you know, at those big companies, the issue is if something fits in between the two jobs, it falls through the cracks, they say. There were no cracks at ours because we stepped on each other. So that was the biggest issue is that was our biggest mistake, staying in our lanes. But we didn't really have lanes. We didn't do any formal job roles or anything like that.
So after the Denise incident, was that a trigger to say, hey, we maybe need to shore up roles and who does what?
It should have been. it probably took 2 or 3 years to get there. And then I'd say the second big issue is we kind of worked 24 hours a day. So, you know, we would talk, you know, we'd be in the car, you know, driving to Ocean City for the weekend or something. And we'd be talking about the hair salon, you know, my son worked there. So, and my daughter worked there also. So, you know, at dinner table, we talk about, oh, this customer came in and this employee did this. So it really became exhausting because even though I wasn't physically there all the time, I wasn't there quite a bit, but you thought about it 24 hours a day.
And at the time, you were still working. I think you were still doing some work in the pharma.
Yeah, I was full-time at Procter & Gamble. Pfizer. So I worked at Pfizer 40 hours a week.
Yeah.
And then I did this nights and weekends, and I had a flexible job, like, you know, most corporate job. It wasn't so flexible, but I could take a phone call during the day. And my office was maybe a quarter mile or less. My Pfizer office was a quarter mile from the hair salon. So I'd walk over there, you know, for, you know, at lunchtime, I'd walk over. Sometimes, you know, I'd take a half hour break in the afternoon. So I was there a lot.
That must have been an interesting chapter. So you bounce from like making a major decision on a global drug launch to, you know, figuring out how to get more shampoo because they just ran out of stock.
It was going back and forth. Once year one, we hired 70 employees. When you go into the hair salon, there were, you know, 6 or 8 people who worked there, but I had basically fired 65 employees. Okay. So someone gets hired for it. So we did a lot of hiring and firing, and that was definitely my job. So, and most of the hiring and firing, you do interviews during the day. Sometimes I'd have them come to my Pfizer office, but most of the times I'd have them come there. So I really thought it's like, hey, I might get fired from Pfizer because, you know, I'm not giving it 100%, you know, because I was torn between the two. Now, you know, luckily, well, from my employer standpoint, luckily I worked, you know, 50 hours a week on it. So even though I was distracted at times, I was still putting in a full day's work. But it was very difficult bouncing back and forth. For the first year, it was quite stressful.
Yeah, it must have been. So let's dive into that a bit more. So you had this, and I remember, you know, full disclosure to our listenership, Scott and I have known each other for probably, what, 20 years?
20 Scott, years, yeah, that'd be my guess.
You know, when I first met you, it was in the context of Fantastic Sam's. When I'm talking about, like, wait a minute, this is a very interesting individual to be running a Fantastic Sam's. And you're like, well, that's not exactly my day job. It's like, oh, I see. So looking back at your time with P&G, with Pfizer, you know, you had access to this, you know, world, global companies with systems, with disciplines, with processes. To what extent did any of that translate into that small family-run business, and how much maybe fit, how much just didn't even equate?
Yeah, I'd say Lots and lots and lots transferred. When I started my pharmaceutical marketing company, we at first called it Healthcare Regional Marketing. We then changed the name to Relevate. But I really wanted to avoid almost anything they did at Procter & Gamble and Pfizer because they were very large bureaucratic organizations. Mm-hmm. But then I quickly learned that, hey, the reason they were $75 billion in sales is they do lots and lots of stuff right. Mm. So I had to figure out, hey, how do I translate that to, you know, my small business, the Fantastic Sam's Hair Salon, or the, you know, medium-sized business, the pharmaceutical marketing company. And, you know, I did. And, you know, one simple thing is at the hair salon, I remember I said, hey, our goal is we're going to be the number one hair salon in Hunterdon County, New Jersey. And I said, hey, here are our strategies. Here's the initiatives. Here's the metrics I'm going to hold everyone accountable for. I had it on one sheet of paper and I had a meeting and everyone handed it out. And someone told me when they left a few years later, she's like, hey, what I really liked about this is like you ran it like a company. I've worked at other hair salons and it's like all, you know, wishy-washy, like you ran this like a real company. So I'd say a lot of the stuff, you know, maybe everything transferred if you just spent time thinking about how to apply it.
And if memory serves, I think you did a little better with Fantastic Sands than just being like number one in the county. In fact,
yes. So there were 1500, there were 1500 hair salons in the country. We were the seventh busiest. And I think we were number two in shampoo sales. So yeah, we did quite well, but it all started with, you know, hey, this is what we're trying to do. So everybody knew, okay, we're going to be number one. What does that mean? And how are we going to do it? And how does it translate to me? Like one time I wanted these people to sell more shampoo. So I did a, you know, 10 minute training on, hey, this is what I want you to do. It wasn't how to sell shampoo. It was more on every single customer. Ed, as you're leaving, I just need to say to you, hey, Ed, do you need any shampoo or conditioner? All you have to do is ask. And there was this little check box. It would have every customer's name who came in that day, the stylist name, and you just check. I asked or I didn't ask. That was it. Mm-hmm. That was the metric. So, you know, some people, you know, would ask 8 out of 10. Some people, you know, would ask 0 out of 10, but they lied and checked, you know, 10 out of 10. So then what happened is some of the people's sales went way up and some stayed flat. Mm-hmm. So the ones who stayed flat, I remember I said to her, I said, hey, how's this going? You know, you're not selling any shampoo. She said, I'm asking everybody. I said, okay, well, what I'm assuming is you're asking wrong. So, hey, maybe Saturday when we close, I'll stick around for an hour and we can role play on how you should actually ask. And she's like, well, how about give me another week? Because she didn't want to stick around Saturday for an hour. Give me another week. And then she started to ask. And lo and behold, sales went up. So, you know, I just had little, you know, tactics, strategies, you know, and metrics to do it. And things started to go really well.
That's awesome. And then what year did you start what ultimately would become Relevate? When did you, I know you.
07. 2007.
Okay, so 2007 to 2020, and was Fantastic Sam's kind of, did you guys part that business or was that?
So I started that in 02.
Okay.
And then 10 years later, sold it in 2012.
Okay. So while Fantastic Sam's was still going, you were starting this new company.
And the main reason to sell Fantastic Sam's was, you know, as a really top hair salon, we did $700,000 a year in revenue, which is good for a hair salon back in 2010.
Sure.
The pharmaceutical marketing company, back in 2010, a really good sale for us was $700,000.
Yeah.
So it was like, hey, like, why am I spending all this time where if I spend half that time getting one new sale, it pays out. So I was like, hey, I need to get rid of this. It's just, it was fun, but it became a business distraction.
Yeah. So it started in 07 with one or two clients. Just talk about that for a moment. Relevate ran up to a rather sizable run when you
went
in 2020.
We started at zero like everybody else. Year one, we were $400,000. Year two, we were $4 million. Year three, we were 8 million. Year four, we were 15. So it was like taking off great. But then 2 years later, we were back at like 6 or 7 million and stayed flat there for like 5, 6 years. We just couldn't figure out, you know, we lost our biggest customer. A big learning was, 80% of our revenue was with one customer. That one customer made huge cutbacks. We came down and we actually purposely wanted to have less customers because we thought if you have many, many customers and you have to treat them all a little differently, we can make mistakes. With less customers, we can deliver a higher quality product. So it was purposeful to be concentrated. And then it came back to bite us hard. And then we stayed flat there for several years.
But then eventually,
So then what happened is I hired a scaling up coach to come in and help us. So at the time we were $7 million. 7 years later, we grew to $70 million. So it was a wild success story. I became a big believer in scaling up and the process. I said it took 7 years. We hired them for 4 years and then we got rid of them and I started to run it ourselves. Mm-hmm. I was a self-implementer, which, I thought I did a better job, but in hindsight, I didn't do as good of a job as that guy, but it's the type of work I enjoy doing. So that's what we did. And so I became a huge believer in that.
So in 2020, when you, I guess you exited Relevate, that's when you made the shift into scaling up coaching.
Yeah. So what happened is I was a huge believer. I sold the company and I guess it was 5 years ago. So I was, 57. And most of my friends, all my friends were working full time. So I'd call you up. Hey, Ed, it's, next Tuesday, you want to go play golf? And you're like, dude, I got to work. So I was like, maybe I should consider, doing something else. And, it took months to think through it. I was like, I wanted to work part-time. I didn't want to work full-time because I did want to do other things. Mm-hmm. I was like, I really enjoyed this scaling up. So the company that we had hired to help us do it was called Petra, which is Latin for rock, because it's all about focusing on your rocks. So I called them and said, hey, would you be interested in having a part-time coach? And they said, yes, definitely. So I got into that. I had probably been, I had sold the business. It must have been 6 months later, maybe a year.
Hmm. And what was it that, was it just the process left such a strong influence on you and that your love for coaching just kind of, was it sort of a natural progression, or did you have to really kind of think on it? Do I really want to do this or should I go another way?
So when I worked at Procter & Gamble, they had a process for setting goals. Mm-hmm. So then when we looked for scaling up, I looked at other systems, EOS, 3HAG, I looked at other systems, and the scaling up was most similar to what I had done at Procter & Gamble. So I liked that structure. So I'm like, hey, let's do this because I'm most comfortable with it, familiar. Mm-hmm. And then when I started doing it myself, implementing, like, hey, this is brilliant. And I would tell my friends, they'd say, having this issue, I was in, EO. I'd say, well, you just got to think about it this way. And people are taking notes. I'm like, this is interesting. Not everybody had the, fortune of working at Procter & Gamble at 21 and, learning this for 10 years. Like, this is not, everyone doesn't know that. I mean, I came to your company one day and did it. And I was like, really, this is interesting that, I consider you very successful, very knowledgeable. Like, he even needs help stepping back and thinking through. So I'm like, okay, everyone has lots of skills. I just happen to be really deep in this area. So this is going to be fun for me. So it's something I enjoy. And I enjoy when, customers are like, hey, this is helpful. So
That's awesome.
Yeah. So that's how it came about.
That's great. That's great. So now today you coach a wide range of businesses. A number of them are family governed businesses. Yeah. When you look at the family run company, what are some patterns you often see when you kind of first, your first meet and greet, when you first walk through the door or have the first conversation, what are some of the common patterns you see in the family governed business?
It's similar to the ones I had talked about we made. It's like there's often not clear roles. There's often not boundaries, like, the 24-hour day type stuff. Especially for spouse companies, the clear roles is a big issue. Like for parent child, and I don't know if you experience this, but it's hard for the parent to be objective. They either think their kid is great or their expectations are way too high. It's like, okay, how's this going to work? So I'd say those are the two big things. And I know when I worked at, I think, Pfizer and Procter & Gamble, but if people were dating, they were supposed to disclose it to their manager. And it's kind of no big deal if you're at Procter & Gamble, because you could be marketing soap and your spouse could be product development paper. You're working at buildings 10 miles apart and you never are in the same campus, let alone meeting together. So it's kind of a non-issue. And if you happen to be dating a coworker, they'll just split you up. There's, tons of jobs. But when you're in a small business, like you're seeing your spouse, your child, like all the time. One of some guy I know said to me, he goes, "Yeah, at one time you were my father, my boss, and my landlord." And it's like, it gets too tough. So and I don't know, how long did your dad work with you?
I think we over, let's see, over, I came in 95 and he retired fully in 2000, so 5 years.
So 5 years. And I'm guessing for the 5 years, you were probably comfortable because, hey, he's the boss. He's got all this experience. He's coaching me. But, towards the end, it's like maybe you're pushing back, and it's difficult, to be 26 years old pushing back on your dad.
Oh, you got to remember, we're crazy passionate Italians, so we fight a lot and we hug it out a lot, and that's pretty much how we roll. So yeah, there was definitely some turbulence. There always is. But getting back to that, we see that a lot, and a lot of guests on the show who are multi-gens. Interestingly, most of them say, because I was the son or the daughter, they were harder on me. The expectation was higher. I can attest to that too. I was expected to, but I didn't fall far from the tree. So working hard and putting in, I mean, that was very natural. That's just what you did, because that's what I watched my
That's what you
whole life.
saw.
So I'm like, yeah, that's what you do. My brothers are the same way, my sister's the same. We're all kind of cut that way. But sometimes I think people get into trouble when that next generation is put into a role that they're not ready for.
Just think, your dad started a company that had zero in revenue, and then, he grew it to, let's say, $50 million, a big business. And then you come on as second generation, and it's like, okay, you didn't get to run a $50,000 company, a $100,000 company, a $500,000, a million. You didn't get to slowly grow over 25 years. All of a sudden now, hey, you got to be CEO of a $5 million, $10 million, $50 million company. It's like, hey, that's a big leap from, hey, I'm, one of the sales reps to now president slash CEO of a multi-million dollar company. It's a huge leap. And, one super common thing I see at small companies versus large corporations, small companies don't have, well, many don't have formal training. You work at big companies. When I worked at Procter & Gamble, I started in May. By the end of August, all the new hires on the class of 85 had started. So starting in September, every Friday from 8:30 till 12, we did training. There was 12 of us. And, head of product development would come in, CFO of the company would come in and do a 4-hour training. And we did 50 of those around, the whole year. And they don't do that at small companies.
No.
There's nothing like that. So it's like, how can you expect? So that'd be the number one thing I see, regardless of sizes. You give them too much responsibility before they can handle it. Your expectations are too high. And you just assume, hey, they're going to know to do it because you know how to do it.
It is sort of a sink or swim, or the training path is more framed as a rite of passage. Longtime client and friend, asked him, I said, what's the first thing you did when you set foot in your company? He said, painted the exterior, like without hesitation. I'm like, oh, so it was time to, you know, it was all, no, that's what you do when you start there. You paint the exterior. So I'm like, really? He's like, yeah, everybody painted the exterior. And there were about 8 family members that had kind of gone through that company. That's what you do. And then if you do a good job at that, they let you in to do some stuff inside.
Yeah. Okay. So to your point, rite of passage, not a formal training program.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but I mean, ultimately amounts to the same, i.e. it's their way of saying, you're going to learn this literally from the ground up with the most menial job, and you're going to do everyone all the way. Because to your point, you know, the founder, that fantastic, you know, you're the CEO who also will sweep the floor and re-clean after it's been cleaned and do the training and do the hiring and a myriad of other things, because you ultimately do what needs doing. So you've also seen, whether it be siblings or husband, wife, or, you know, maybe father, son, but ultimately multiple family members in a business that, you know, sometimes they thrive, sometimes they implode, right? So in your experience, Scott, what separates the ones that scale from the ones that stall?
Yeah, so for, you know, siblings, like I've seen siblings that when I start talking, and I'll start off with, hey, let's look 10 years from now, 10 to 30 years to BHAG. So depending on the age, you know, if they're, you know, 50 years old, we're not going to look out 30 years, but we're going to look to, you know, retirement age. But if they're younger, hey, let's look out. And when one talks about grow, 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 and the other talks about like work-life balance, hey, I want to grow while attending my kids' baseball games. I'm like, hey, this is an issue because you guys are on different pages, you know, different goals. So that'd be one implode. With siblings, what, you know, it's just luck I've seen is when one sibling's a lot older, you know, 10 years older, it seemed to work better because it's like, okay, you can be the big sister or the big brother, and the other one expects, okay, they're going to be in charge for a while till I, you know, kind of grow up. And then, you know, 10 years later, the other one's ready to kind of wind down and take over.
Yeah,
that's worked for, you know, Gen 1, Gen 2. It's really, hey, are they okay having job descriptions and, you know, what I call scorecards? And even the owner holds themselves accountable. It's like, hey, this is what I'm going to do this quarter. These are the 5 metrics for me. These are the 5 metrics for you. And when they don't do it, they live up to it. So it's really, for Gen 1, Gen 2, it's being very formal about it, structured like they would at the big companies. And then for the siblings, it's like, if you're on different pages, and you might not even know it, that you're on different pages unless you overtly and intentionally have those conversations, which most people don't think about it. And I come in there, I don't know what's going on. So I have to ask, you know, basic questions. And when they don't know the answer, I'm like, yeah, this is going to be a problem.
When I walk into a business where there's a first gen or second, third, and that next generation is, you know, in that transitional mode, one of the things that I often look for is a sense of whether or not they have a vision that's their own.
Yeah.
Because typically on a generational transition, so much has changed. To say the parent, who was the founding parent, they're about to age out, which means probably all of their clients that they knew and built relationships with, they're probably have aged out or are getting closer.
Right.
There's a new generation of buyers. They may or may not emotionally and generationally connect with the older founder. The landscape of the marketplace may have changed, new competition, new marketplace dynamics. So everything has sort of changed.
Right.
And if that next generation is saying, well, I'm going to kind of do things a little better than my mom or dad, that's not a vision. So I often say it doesn't even have to be a very good vision. It's just, they just have to own it, you know?
Right. It has to be theirs.
And make it their own. And I'm sure, you know, if I go back to some of my old notes, you know, my early visions for Dalia Associates, what it could be, were probably very crude, you know, and very optimistic and very unrealistic, right? But they were mine.
You took over in 2000.
Yeah.
Guesstimate how long after 2000 were, you know, 90% of your father's customers gone.
We retained one of like the core customers for probably 33 years across, you know, so ironically, when they split, that client's kids who had not been born had started a firm. So essentially she gave it to her kids. So I'm like, well, I can't be too mad at that. They were a client for 33 years and it's being passed on to their kids. And like, that's kind of an interesting, you know, that's a new one. I've never seen that segue before,
Right.
but there's something a little bit heartwarming about it. And I was okay with it. But, you know, a lot of them were actually some in cases clients that I brought on even as like a 22, 23 year old. So
okay.
I kind of had a knack for that. My dad was a master of relationships. He was great at building long-standing relationships. He wasn't great at new business development, though.
Okay. But I'm just, the point is, like, you took over in 2020. Had you not got new customers
yeah.
2005, it would have been out of business. So
yes.
Basically,
yes.
by 2005, it was a new company. You know, so it's like,
very much
hey,
so, yeah.
You know, they're not going to stick around forever. And especially in your case, if he's a master of long-term relationships, like they connected with him over the years, like you're a stranger, like
yeah.
you have to sell them and they're not going to stick around many for 33 years. So it's like,
Yeah,
I got to build my own company and I just have this runway to start. You know, it's better than starting from scratch, but not 1,000 times better. Like, you
no,
have a
no, it's
challenges.
there are unique challenges to taking it the next leg of the race. And I think you pointed to some really well by saying, hey, these are the challenges of the founder generation, markedly different when you step into a company that's already running, you know, a
Right.
whole different set of challenges. And, you know, when I first showed up, you know, a lot of things, like I asked a lot of questions. Why are we doing this way?
Right.
What's the way we've always done it? Okay. Be not the best answer, but okay, let's look into that. Is there a better way? You know, so running into things like that. And again, not to take jabs at the people that were here, because they're good people, you know, and that's what they knew. So that's just where they were at. And it took like a, you know, I guess a fresh perspective to say, well, maybe there's a better way. You know, there's a different.
When I was at a Procter & Gamble, every 18 months to 2 years, they switched who was the brand manager, assistant brand manager of a different, you know, product. And I was like, this is crazy. Like, it takes you a year to get up to speed. And then you're finally hitting your stride and they're switching you out. And it was all about, it's like, hey, these brands are going to be here way longer than any individual. And we constantly want fresh ideas. So they switched. And I remember when I switched, I go into my manager's office, you know, Friday afternoon. And he's like, hey, just want to let you know, or it was Thursday, Monday, you have a new job. You're moving from a bar soap to antiperspirant starting Monday morning at 8 o'clock. I'm like, are you kidding? I got so much to do. He goes, hey, good news. He goes, Friday morning, you know, Ed's taking over your soap job. So Friday, I need you to spend 4 hours bringing Ed up to speed on everything you're doing. He'll attend all the meetings next week. He's the new Scott. And Friday afternoon, you're going to sit down with Susie. You're taking over all her stuff. You're going to spend, so you don't have time to ponder, is this a good idea or bad idea?
Yeah.
I'm told Thursday at 4 o'clock, Friday is transition morning to the new person taking over. Afternoon's this, and then it's all fresh ideas. So
wow.
I think that's a bit much, but from what you said, it's like, hey, I got to ask these questions. They need new ideas because, you know, in 30 years, the market's changed. Even in,
yes.
you know, 5 years, the market's changed.
Yeah. Absolutely. So this comes up a lot, and it's not surprising when a family business is scaled to a point and private equity suddenly starts knocking at their door. And for many, many reasons, you know, a well-running family-governed multi-generation business in the eyes of private equity was very attractive for all the wonderful things that the family-governed business can bring. And, you know, now they're pondering, you know, do we go the next generation? Is there a next generation, or is it time? You know, whereas this generation is the last generation, there's nobody coming. It's time to sell. Relevate, going back to your company that you scaled to an amazing level, you got to that point where selling made sense, I guess. So talk a little bit about that. What brought you there and how did you kind of emotionally go from the builder of that business to ultimately the seller of that business?
Yeah. So what brought us to the point was I had a partner and we had insurance on each other, you know, key man insurance. So we came to the point, it's like, hey, if you pass, I don't necessarily want to be partners with your wife. You know, I know her, she's a nice person, but like, I don't need to be partners with her. And let's be honest, she can't do the job you're doing because because you have 20 years experience. Even if she's twice as smart, it's going to take a while. So not only are you going to have to give her half the money of the company, which where's this money coming from? Therefore, we need insurance, because if the company's worth $1 million, I don't have a half a million sitting around to give her. And now I got to hire someone to do your job. So we had the insurance and the premiums became ridiculous. So our number one expense was, you know, payroll and benefits, everything. Number two was this insurance. Yeah. I was like, this is crazy. We're doing this. Hey, we got to think of another option. At the same time, to your point, private equity's calling, and someone called us and we ask on the phone, it's like, about how much is this going to be worth? And they tell us a number, which in my opinion is double what it's worth. And it's like, you know, crazy big money, you know, life-changing money. So I'm like, hey, why don't we actually meet the, and we did not like the buyer. We knew that person. I was like, there's no way I would ever sell to them. Like, I'd rather go bankrupt than sell to this SOB.
Okay.
So I'm like, hey, let's meet with this guy, go through the whole process. And because we know there's no way we're going to sell, but we'll take it to the point of getting a real offer. So he makes us the real offer, which is actually a little bit higher than he told us with the, you know, quick and dirty math. So I was like, okay, this is even higher. So it made me think, hey, it's really worth this. Let's go now find a buyer we like. So okay. Now that we knew the true, we found the buyer we liked, and, you know, to maintain his reputation as an SOB, when we finally sold, it was for double what the SOB was going to give us. So everything worked out. It's like, okay, yeah, that guy was also trying to steal from us. So it was just the money was so big. And like none of my kids showed, you know, passion for this. It's like, mm-hmm. You know, they weren't thinking, you know, I remember my daughter, my son, I'll talk about him in a minute, but he worked as an accountant and he was supporting pharmaceutical companies. He was mm-hmm. auditing pharmaceutical companies. He worked for Price Waterhouse, and he'd come home and say, oh my gosh, this pharmaceutical industry is terrible. I would never want to work in it, blah, 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 blah. I need to tell my boss at work, put me on other accounts. So my daughter's hearing all this. When she's ready to graduate, I'm like, hey, I could probably, and she wants to go into marketing. I'm like, hey, I can get you a job. You know, I know tons of people in the pharmaceutical industry are going, I would not work in that industry if it was the last thing I did. She actually worked for, both of them worked for me for the summer. They didn't like it. So it's like, okay, let's just sell and be done. He had the same situation. Mm-hmm. His kids had no interest in it. But then selling the business is tough because, you know, it's a full-time job to sell it. Mm-hmm. And if you know, start to dip, you start to lose a lot of money on the sale. What we were smart at is the CFO did a lot of the financials, because private equity wants to know the numbers. That's the main thing. And my role at the company, I spent a lot of time on business development. So selling our services to pharma companies was what I did every day. So all selling the company to private equity was the same process. Hey, I built a presentation deck and I delivered it. So mm-hmm. once I, you know, got the deck down, which wasn't that hard because it's kind of how I think, I just delivered. So it didn't take a lot of time. And I knew this was going to be the last generation. But there was mm-hmm. the emotion of, it's like, okay, like, what's next? And I decided, hey, you know, I've talked to plenty of people who saw that. It's like, hey, I'm not going to think about that until after I leave, because they're going to probably make me stay for a while after I leave, and I'm not going to do anything for at least 6 months. Mm-hmm. And the coaching, it might have been 5 months, it might have been 12, but it was probably, you know, somewhere between 6 and 12 months is when I started. Mm-hmm. But I really wanted to think, hey, what do I want to do next? And mm-hmm. you know, unfortunately, I've seen people get sick, and I'm like, my best friend got cancer. He's still alive, but he got cancer at 50. So it's like, okay, there's no guarantee. So, and I actually recently read something that it has the age you retire, you know, starting at, let's say, 50 to 70, and then the age you pass. And there's an inverse correlation. So I was like, okay, like this all makes sense. So the physical part, the I should say the tactics to sell became easy. You know, we split it up the CFO, and then the emotion. I did enough time saying, okay, I'm ready to go. But I loved my job. But I'll tell everybody, it's like, I love my job. Not working, you love even more. So if you can financially afford it, I think not working is even better.
So what was that emotion that you've like, can you, if you go back to the day that it closed, like, what was that feeling like to say, we're done and this is done? Like, talk about how you felt.
So it wasn't that black and white in terms of being done, because I had to, you know, it was a I had to sign a 3-year contract, though. After less than a year, they said, okay, you can leave now. But I remember my partner, he was doing the financial. So he went to the bank and said, hey, I want to transfer $1 into this account. And the lady's like, hey, to do that, it's going to be $25. I don't think you really want to do that. He's like, no, I want to do this. I want to make sure without a doubt this works. So does it. And then I get a text, check the statement. And you check the statement and there's this massive number in there. I was like, oh my gosh. Like, I'm just like staring at my screen for, you know, 90 seconds. Like this is so much. And someone told me, he's like, hey, I've seen people sell for, you know, super ridiculous, $100 million on Friday. And then Monday, they're arguing with the PE firm about what color the outside of the building should be. And he's like, hey, don't do that. So it took, you know, a week until they said something stupid, right? It wasn't a day, but it was a week. And I was like, hey, you know, this isn't mine anymore. So the immediate seeing the, you know, on my screen, that number was, you know, it was just like, I felt, I just stopped, took my breath away. It's, oh my gosh, this is real now. That's And then, you know, a week later when they said their first stupid thing, I was like, hey, I got to let this go. And, you know, it might not have been stupid, but, you know, if it wasn't my idea, it was stupid. That's a slight exaggeration, but you get the idea. So that took a while. And, you know, frankly, I didn't enjoy working there after they owned it. Like, it wasn't fun. And, you know, I remember I had to do a project with this other person. I go to my partner's like, hey, like, I don't want to work with this person. So what are you talking about? I'm like, you know, I just don't want to do it. Like, it's a pain in the neck. And he's like, well, someone's going to do it. I'm like, it's not going to be me. you know, he's like, yeah, I get it. Like, and I'm like, if we can't find anyone else, I'll always do it. I'm not going to, you know, make you do it. Cause it was clearly, you know, we had clear roles. It was clearly my role, his, but I'm like, hey, you know, let's get Susie to do it. And she'll do, you know, 70% of a good job, but like, I just don't care. And when I had that conversation, I'm like, you know, so then I went to them, private equity, said, hey, we need to replace me eventually. This is the criteria. I think we need to find someone. And they said, all right, well, you know, take a year, find somebody. Like, 2 weeks later, I had the first candidate. They didn't like him. They liked the second candidate. And then it quickly, you know, they knew I didn't really want to be there anymore.
Yeah. But that's great. Thank you so much for that share and the candor in that. So looking back across the whole span from selling bagels in the gas line to confetti to pools to Fantastic Sam's and a great career in pharma as well, to growing a business, selling it at a very high level. What, you know, if you were to say, let me offer up one piece of advice for one of our listeners that might be in that family governed business, one great takeaway from that you've learned, a life lesson or a business lesson, what would be a great takeaway to wrap up with?
Yeah, I'd say try to apply some of the corporate thinking around clear roles, clear goals, clear vision, all that stuff. And remember, you know, even though you're taking out the trash, you still have to be the visionary and hold everyone accountable.
Excellent. So last question, Scott, if any of our listeners want to connect with you to learn more about your coaching work, what's the best way for them to reach out?
LinkedIn would be the best. And then my email is scott2xresults@gmail.com.
Excellent, excellent. Well, Scott, thank you so much for a very grounded and practical and invigorating conversation. Your experience as both a family business owner and as a scaling up coach and before give you a rare perspective, and your insights today will resonate with leaders across every generation, I would say. Again, we've been speaking with Scott Weintraub of Scaling Up Coaches, and I'm your host, Ed D'Elia, and this has been another episode of Growing Up B2B. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time. Scott, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Ed.
Hey, thanks so much for tuning into Growing Up B2B. To explore more episodes and insights, visit podcast.delianet.com. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please give us a rating or review on your podcast platform of choice. Having worked with hundreds of family-led businesses across my career, and being a second-generation leader myself, I'm on a mission to help every family business I meet achieve next-level growth for their organization. So feel free also to connect with me on LinkedIn and let's support each other. You can also find out more about my company at DeliaNet.com. Again, I'm your host, Ed D'Elia, and thanks so much for joining us today. Take care.